The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you for settling in. We look forward to an interesting next panel and thank our first panelists for setting the stage in terms of domestic implementation and the use of the UDHR in courts and constitutions and their applications regionally. This session is meant to talk about international supervision and enforcement. Certainly one of the issues that is most pressing and in some ways most controversial about the place of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and universal norms generally. Today we have sophisticated regional systems for the promotion and protection of human rights in various regions of the world. We have a variety of core human rights treaties which serve to codify and complete the Universal Declaration. We have an active United Nations. We have widespread awareness of the concept and application of human rights in many parts of the world. And yet, we find that this legal structure is not enough. The gap between articulated and adopted norms versus real adherence and promotion of human rights is huge. And any of us who have worked in this field feel that, know that, and see that in its operation. Genocide continues to occur 60 years after the Genocide Convention was adopted. Homelessness persists despite the right to adequate housing enshrined in the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Covenant. Torture continues despite its prohibition in the ICCPR and the Convention Against Torture. Racism is rampant despite the legal protections of ICERD. I actually don't mean to be such a downer. But commissions and court systems have been developed to oversee and enforce the implementation of these norms, and in some ways they have been effective. The Inter-American and European Courts of Human Rights have had some degree of effectiveness to press change as individual and group petitions are heard, and yet criticism abounds regarding the ability and commitment of the international community to actually implement the norms that they and we have adopted. There's no international police force to ensure that commitments are enforced. The effectiveness of the oversight committees which exist on the universal UN level is varied. The optional protocols which provide an opportunity for individual petitions at UN treaty bodies remain optional and have limited scope. Today we have four noted speakers who will explore various aspects of the challenge of international enforcement and supervision for universal human rights norms and the UDHR specifically. We're fortunate that they could all join us and share their unique perspectives and opinions. I direct you to their bios in the handout, and in the interest of time, I'll give you only abbreviated introductions, which I hope you will forgive as they will not do justice to the vast contributions that each of our speakers has made to the field of human rights. First on our panel is Dean Claudio Grossman, who is Dean of American University Washington College of Law. Dean Grossman was unanimously elected chair of the United Nations Committee Against Torture in April 2008, where he's been a member since 2003. He's also a member of the Commission for the Control of Interpol's Files. Previously, he was a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights from 1993 to 2001 and served in various capacities, including twice as its president. He has a rich and robust career in the field of international human rights. He's well known around the world for the advocacy and work that he has done and has been a stalwart supporter of the work that we do here at American University Washington College of Law. We look forward to your comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Hadar. As we're talking about implementation of supervision, let me first say a couple of things about the process of norm creation, because to a certain extent, norm creation precedes supervision. Supervision, the concept is to measure the behavior against standards. So we need to have some yardsticks in order to be able to measure. And then, in the terminology of international law, that process was called norm creation. The process of norm creation is pretty much completed. It has been a difficult process, and I think as we're celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration, we need to take a moment and pause as to what has been achieved in norm creation. Let us not forget that when the Universal Declaration was adopted as a standard of achievement, as an expression of a moral obligation. There was not agreement that any of these rights were rights in the legal term. And it was something unbelievable, and an instrument that for the first time invented human beings at the international level. I mean, every provision, all human beings are born free, everyone. Everyone has the right to life, liberty. No one shall be held in slavery. No one shall be subject to torture. And everyone has the right to recognition, so forth and so on. This, before the Universal Declaration, this did not exist. So this idea that all of us, human beings, irrespective of religion, race, preferences, are entitled to something was a revolutionary step in the world, and a reason for celebration. It's interesting to note also that the Universal Declaration suffered a transformation due to the operation, as we mentioned, of customary law. Many, if not all, its rights, norms became rights, and also through the operation of treaty law. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, universal treaties like it, 1966, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, treaties that relate to individuals or to some rights. We're talking the rights of labor, the women, children, the provision of genocide. All this created norms in the international level that allow us to claim now that the process of norm creation pretty much has been completed. Now, again, due to political reasons, different groups continue to ask for a special treaties that reflect deeply needed aspirations. For example, recently approved the Disability Convention. I mean, it seems that continue adding to treaties is a way to achieve recognition concerning special claims. And again, we could have achieved those through interpretation of different norms, but the political strength of groups, and we could understand this, continues to add to the need of adopting treaties and norms. But generally speaking, we have created a set of norms that allow us more to focus on implementation. There is another thing that is important in the creation of these norms. The paper has patience. We can put anything that we want in a paper. And certainly sometimes policymakers treat these norms as aspiration of as valid aspirations, but as expression of morals. And there is no shortage on realists that continue to claim that policymakers have only almost unlimited possibilities to do anything. It seems to me that the strength of these norms and the process of norm creation has created a powerful movement internationally and domestically in many countries that makes more likely than not operational these values from the political point of view. You know, we can spend here a lot of time saying that dying of hunger is something that does not violate any right, but with 1,400,000,000 people who are living in absolute poverty, the powerful voice of these people in different societies cannot be ignored. They have the ability to transform. And in certain conditions, for example, in this hemisphere, where you have 34 out of 35 countries who have free elections, relatively free elections, all the countries except Cuba, well, we see that the poor have a voice. So when some people continue to insist, well, you're poor, and in addition to that, you don't have rights. I mean, there's no right to think. Well, other groups claim that they are entitled to it and to eat, and that creates a situation that is operational from the point of view. So my thesis on this in terms of norm creation is that we have created and strengthened aspiration, expectations of behavior that are politically operational. And more likely than not, when policymakers forget or violate this norm, more likely than not, there is a possibility that things are not going to go well. So irrespective of discussions involving the political value of human rights, they provide a guide of behavior. And I will suggest the following. when a policymaker suggests that torture or interpretations of torture, and as chair of the committee against torture, I've seen this in many contexts, particularly when there is emergency situation, I think we need to tell those policymakers, take a moment to think, because again, violating these rights more likely than not could create problems. There could be situations that, you know, this is not a film of John Wayne where they win, the good people win all the time, but from the point of view of right, the value of these norms is operational. And so be aware that violation of these norms could have serious political consequences. If not in every instance, in many instances. So the burden of proof has shifted. And perhaps that's a message for realism and for people who work realistically. And the paradigm of Morgenthau of realism in international relations have captured the imagination and the action of policymakers. If we argue you should not do something because it's the wrong thing to do, people will tell you, well, work in a church or in an NGO or something else, but don't work in policymaking. Well, I think that, however, certainly, concerning fundamental human rights, the realists should incorporate this idea that these values are, many of these values are operational, and more likely than not, there could be a problem if they are violated. Well, while we have established legitimacy, there are different gradations in different systems, the process of norm creation is, of course, not over. We need to continue to require a reduction of reservations involving treaties, the incorporation of treaties in the domestic realm, and so forth and so on. Now, many, particularly the cynic, follow very much sometimes the Anatole France. Anatole France used to say, what is the value of the prohibition of the principle of equality before the law? Said Anatole France. The equality before the law prohibits both the rich and the poor to sleep under the bridges, he said. But for me, that is a cynical expression, because the embodiment of these values as norms creates the space to claim for its application. And if we compare what we have created in the world to the situation existing prior to the Second World War, where every country has, generally speaking, the right to treat and mistreat its citizens as the country wanted, we see now the transformation that have occurred, because we have rejected this idea that the principle of national sovereignty allowed everyone to do what every country wanted, and created a powerful movement with different expressions of strength in different countries that is operationally valid. So the process of norm creation is, as I said before, generally concluded. And then we can talk, because that has happened, of implementation of supervision. Now, let me give a warning in terms of supervision. Supervision is usually thought of as measuring behavior against standards. But supervision also means norm creation. It's not just measuring things against torture, because of the nature of language, for example. I can give you many examples out of my own experience in the Inter-American Commission, the Commission Against Torture. Is rape a form of torture, for example? The treaties didn't say anything about that explicitly, but the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights decided that it was a form of torture. The American Convention didn't say that explicitly. So there is a process of creation through the supervisory organ. Or disappearances. In the first case that was presented to Inter-American Court on Human Rights, Manfred Angel Velasquez against Honduras, the government of Honduras said that disappearances were not prohibited by the convention. And again, the court decided that this was not criminal law. There was not a need to typify every aspect of behavior, but for example, a principle to be recognized a person before the law, the prohibition of violation of the right to life, all of this included the prohibition of disappearances. And there are so many norms that are important in this respect. The interpretation of what constitutes torture by the Committee Against Torture of the United Nations, the content of the principle of non-refoulement. And so all these things are the result of supervision, which is then not just measuring behavior against a standard. There is a very creative function. Now, so what are the type of supervision and the challenges for supervision? I think we have domestic and international. Domestically is the incorporation, for example, of norms into the domestic realm, and the prior panel said something about that. We have horizontal supervision, states, for example, claiming that an international obligation has been violated, individual states. We have then collective political supervision, the General Assembly of the United Nations, the General Assembly of the Organization of American States, under the Council of Europe, I mean, forms of collective political supervision. We have then semi-judicial supervision done by organs like the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the Committee Against Torture, that seek the truth resorting to the legal system, to notions of law, you know, and decide again on the basis of legal reasoning, but the decisions are recommendations. And then we have forms of judicial supervision. Now, the big challenge for the international community is to move, since the process of non-creation has been pretty much completed, to implementation and supervision that includes, of course, a creative component. And generally speaking, I would say everything should be done better. And second thing, the best is to the incorporation into domestic realm, and second thing, to move towards judicial forms of supervision. Let me say something about each of these forms. Incorporation. Incorporation, of course, is a matter of knowledge. First of all, the judges feel easier when they talk about domestic issues than about international issues. We need to take into account that. Also, the operation of classic international law that made a strict separation between international and domestic. I think we're in a process of transition. The treaties of human rights are treaties of a different sort. They don't relate to reciprocal obligation among states. And to a certain extent, this idea of dualism, that you can ratify a treaty but doesn't have any application internally, is a dinosaur that continue initially to operate on the basis of a different world reality where we didn't have this type of treaty. You know, when we have treaties involving borders or treaties involving you sell and I buy, it's different than when we're establishing treaties that say, for example, you will not torture, or you will not raise taxes, or you are going, I mean, this, because of the nature, intention, I mean, we need to start revising this thing. Also politically, Why should we allow countries that say, I ratify everything, but I don't apply it internally? And I don't apply it internally, and I ratify it because international law is weak, and I'm not going to be supervised. I mean, it is time that we start looking at the fundamental ethical issues that are involved in not taking the law seriously. I mean, and perhaps we will, if the future of the international human rights regime depends on looking very seriously at this issue of domestic implementation. That, okay, I ratify, but you are not entitled to go to a judge internally. When, in particular, those treaties involve domestic internal obligations of states. So I think that this is an area of thinking and reflection that needs to be exposed, presented, and we need to talk about the experience. And as we transform these things, the United Nations has a role, and the High Commissioner, in terms of training, for example, and establishing a presence in the field. I mean, also in the promotion of rights. Now, let me see. Another thing is horizontal supervision, the classic way of acting in international law. One state supervises what other states do. I think that there are problems with that because of the reasons why states operate, strategic, economic, political. Also, there are human rights considerations in the behavior of states to the extent that they, and they can be translated in ethical, let me see, in norms that need to be respected because of state interest in whatever way they are perceived. Horizontal supervision continues to be valid. I belong to a school of thought that says that if nothing is functioning and if there is genocide, you know, I prefer action by an individual state than inaction on the basis of a wrong interpretation of the principle of non-intervention. I mean, if there is genocide, I think that there is a role for horizontal supervision. Now, horizontal supervision has dangers. Everything has dangers in life, but I think that we need to preserve a space for that. Now, we need to do better horizontal supervision. It's not bad to have congresses, NGOs focusing on foreign affairs and how to put a component that is realistic. Because if we come to a conclusion that if another government is violating human rights, most likely the population is not in agreement with that government, and in the long term, perhaps, realism dictates a need to incorporate ethical norms in the conduct of foreign affairs. So I think we need to do better and increase the role that civil society, Congress, different actors have in the formulation, implementation, and action in foreign policy. Now, let me see. Because of time, let me move to collective political. One collective political is, for example, in a Universal Periodic Review done by the United Nations, the Human Rights Council. How is effective collective political supervision? If we have record keeping, if it is public, if there is a role for the civil society, if people know what is going on, and how can we do things better? And this applies also to a system of Universal Periodic Review. I think it's good to have coalitions of countries that promote human rights, north and south, and we can do better in that respect. And to achieve that, publicity is important, the role of civil society and national instruments that promote human rights. Much more can be done in that respect. I think there is a role for the United States, who has not been engaging in the Universal Periodic Review. And I foresee that I've been wrong many times, but I hope I won't be wrong in this one, that the new administration in the United States will re-engage in the Universal Periodic Review system, and we need that re-engagement for the purposes of increasing the role that the Universal Periodic Review system done by all the states that part of the Human Rights Council can perform. I mean, it's now, that being said, there is a role to political supervision, and I think that the political supervision, because it's political, has some problems. I mean, that's why we have judges and independent actors. Still, also, that can be done better, and I suggested increased role for NGOs, coalitions, and publicity. Now, semi-judicial, for example, committing a torture, of the United Nations, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, different procedures. We have 9 treaty bodies under treaty, independent experts, and so forth. How can this improve and have more input? Public meetings, for example. There are some public meetings, and it would be interesting for the population of some countries to hear what their representatives are saying before these bodies. And I have thought, and I will make that proposal, to the Committee Against Torture in the next meeting, that we webcast and podcast the, for example, public part of the meeting of the Committee Against Torture. I think every country would benefit from that, and since it is public in accordance with our regulation, what's wrong in making it public? It would afford the states a possibility to tell their story. And I will say something. If you detect any sentiment against states, the states have ratified these treaties in order to allow their population to act even against them. So we wouldn't be here had it not been by this commitment by states. So we need to do it better in terms of publicity. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights is doing that now with very salutary effects to podcast all the public hearings of the committee. Now, second thing that I think will be important, to move the machinery to the places in regions. I intend, as chair of the Committee Against Torture, to see whether we can have a meeting in Costa Rica, for example, the headquarters of the Inter-American Court on Human Rights. Why? Because that brings these procedures closer to people. Don't forget that the role of this procedure is not to criticize states on the basis of political reason, but to engage states in a constructive dialogue with the purposes of promoting values of human dignity, values that they have freely acquired by ratifying this treaty. Third important thing are mechanisms like, for example, OPCA, the Optional Protocol to a Convention Against Torture, and there are similar developments to this thing. What does OPCA do? It creates national preventive mechanisms that have a possibility of going every place. So it's a combination of domestic preventive and the international repressive or repressive places where you present through different techniques your view. So, for example, thinking on prevention by techniques like the development of domestic review mechanism with an ability to go everywhere is essential. Now, let me see. Follow-up procedures, that's another thing that is crucial. I always remember a dictator in Central America who used to say, I don't know why people complain about the lack of free elections here. Everyone can vote. Everyone can be a candidate. Huh? Everyone, you know, can present his or her view, usually his view, to the society at large. The only thing I do, he said, is to count the votes. And people complain about that. Well, again, if we have all these mechanisms, except no follow-up, we have a big problem. Now, the Committee Against Torture has developed a follow-up procedure, which is, and with two rapporteurs, one for the process of reporting that happens every 4 years, and then the rapporteur sends letters, communications that require, and we identify issues that need reporting not every 4 years, but every year, and with press conferences, the mobilization of public opinion, and then we have the system of petition also with the rapporteur. We can do much more, however. We don't have hearings on each individual, country on follow-up, and there are issues of resources, but there are always issues of resources. The key thing is to do things without resources. With resources, everyone can do everything. So when people say we don't have resources, and you know, the key issue is to do everything without resources. So I think we need to increment, without resources, the follow-up procedure. Finally, before Hadar Harris throws me out of the podium here, I want to say that a key other issue in terms of the United Nations is harmonization. When we have 9 treaty bodies, a universal periodic review, there are issues in terms of possible, and in some cases real, contradictions in interpretation. And legitimacy has, as a very important component, not double standards, and an homogeneous response to everything. Now, the former High Commissioner made a point in the sense of trying to create one single system, you know, that will embrace all the different treaty bodies. But that did not prove to be politically realistic in the current stage of development of international human rights law. So the key word now is harmonization, meetings of committee chairs, meeting of, meetings on topics and rights. The other important thing is the role that the High Commissioner could play, because these independent organs meet twice or 3 times per year, but the lawyers serving them respond to a High Commissioner and are the same, so they could rotate. And 80% of this is the decisions, preparations, and documents done by the lawyers working with the High Commissioner. So there is space and possibility to do much more on harmonization. Finally, the best is judicial supervision. It plays also a role preventively. You know, in the struggle against impunity, I have seen that one people that goes to jail is better than 100 lessons about anything. So there is a role of prevention when you have, when we have judicial organs deciding in accordance with the legal tradition different, deciding on violation. And it is not easy to get to judiciary, but I want to mention that we have in this hemisphere now 25 countries that have accepted the Inter-American Court on Human Rights. In the Council of Europe, we have a thing. And more than anything, we should not accept that this is not possible. I think that we can shape reality. We're not just witnessing as a peasant that watches and sees it's going to rain, not to rain. We can do things. We can imagine things and bring them to realization. Somebody would have told me 20 years ago that an African American was going to be elected president of the United States. You know, somebody said, you should not run because African. I would have said, well, that's pretty difficult. Eh? And that enough is a challenge, this idea that we should not push for fundamental and drastic change. Somebody would have said that the Berlin Wall would have been would finish. I would have said that's very difficult. If somebody would have told me that Pinochet was going to be detained in London and the principle of universal jurisdiction was going to be developed, I would have said no, very, very, very difficult. So while we are realistic in terms of developing different norms, I think we need to continue to assert some principles and create through our own behaviors space for that. And I would suggest also that the principle of judicial supervision is essential for the implementation at the end of these norms. Well, thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dean Grossman, for your overview and ideas about what to do on the universal level. Our next speaker is Dr. Joaquin Gonzalez Ibanez. My Spanish is so good. He is a lecturer and researcher of international law and European Union law at the University Alfonso X El Sabio of Madrid and a Fulbright Schumann visiting scholar at WCL this year, where his area of research is the U.S. as guardian or violator of the rule of law, Guantanamo from the European perspective. Not that the Europeans have a lot of perspectives on Guantanamo. I mean, I don't know what you have to write about, really. He's been a visiting scholar at Harvard Law School as well as Shanghai University. He has a PhD in access to education, and his publications vary on human rights and globalization. And we're very pleased to have him here to talk with us today about the challenge to supervision and enforcement from a European perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to start by thanking Hadar Harris and Claudia Grossman for the opportunity of sharing some thoughts about the European system. And mostly, I'm here glad to act as a citizen, an European citizen, as a worldwide, someone with a worldwide perspective, I hope, and to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration. My comments, I hope, will complement the Mr. Kwarkiwi assessment about the Council of Europe, but what I will do is to share with you some reflection about the current state of the protection of human rights in the Council of Europe, but what is the future that the Europeans will be facing in the coming years. First of all, we are now celebrating not just the 60th anniversary, but we celebrate in Europe the 50th anniversary of next month. We will celebrate the 50th anniversary of the adoption of the European Convention of Human Rights. We also celebrate the 10th anniversary of the entry into force of the 11th Protocol. This is a protocol that merged, that meant the creation of a new European court in Strasbourg, melting together the Commission and the former Court of Human Rights. And of course, we celebrate the 60th anniversary. I think for the last 10 years, or 13 years in the academia, I celebrate every single day this day, and I always do it quoting my favorite civic hero, which is Nelson Mandela. the 27 years that he spent in Robben Island, he said that every single day he read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights because it contains the human aspiration of humankind. And he said that he thought that one day those aspirations will be enforceable, will be part of the ethics of the, of his community. And he also said that a sign of the respect of countries for the Universal Declaration would be to have printed it out in every single passport. So what I'll do is, in order to understand where we are heading to, where we are going to in the European system, I would like to look back in the past and see what are the origins of the convention. And I think it's vital to understand what are the major challenges facing Europeans. First of all, I would like to mention Winston Churchill. We are here probably, or the European system has a lot to pay to the figure of Winston Churchill, and also the wisdom of the British citizenship. I don't know if you remember that the first democratic elections after World War II in the UK, the British thought that the man that has taken them to victory, Winston Churchill, was not the right person to lead reconstruction and peace in the UK. So they voted for Attlee, so in a way Winston Churchill was unemployed. Thankfully, he deserved his efforts to thinking about Europe. And you probably will remember this famous speech in the University of Zurich when he said, an iron curtain has fallen over Europe, we must preserve our liberties. His idea, he re-elaborated the thought of Victor Hugo, we need to create the United States of Europe, and he started to work in an international arena. The Statute of St. James, which is the founding charter of the Council of Europe, contained precisely the aspiration of Winston Churchill of, we must preserve rule of law, democracy, and human rights as our unique way of developing our societies. So what I'm saying is that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the preamble, it mentions explicitly the horrendous chapter of World War II created by we Europeans. What I'm saying is that 1949 was created the Council of Europe, and in 1950, when it was part of the European Covenant of Human Rights, there were two elements contained in the European Covenant. The first one was never to repeat the tragic events in world history that took place in Europe, especially the Endlösung, the Holocaust. But at the same time, it's a convention thought from the Western point of view, democratic values, and it was conceived like a promotion of Western values in contrast to communist interests. It's important, if you visit the European Court on Human Rights, any judge would invite you to pay visit just 35 kilometers from Strasbourg to the concentration camp of Nazwiller Struthof, and he would reply you that the main goal of the European was to create an institution that might embed the principles that were deleted and forgotten during the Second World War. Nowadays, after this foundation in 1950, remember the Iron Curtain that Mr. Winston Churchill mentioned has fallen. We Europeans say that the 21st century started the 8th of November 1989 when the wall was turned down by people's expectations, people's aspirations. And what I wanted to point out is that the very goals that Winston Churchill mentioned, human rights, strengthening the rule of law, and democracy, are still the very reason of the Council of Europe protection of human rights. The present state that is holding the chair, Sweden, in the last report of the Committee of Ministers, mentioned that his main endeavors are focused in the consolidation of the Council of Europe system of protection of human rights, strengthening democracy and good governance, and reinforcing the rule of law in Europe. We are now in 2008, and I would like to lead and to continue the words of Mr. Hammarbeck, which is the Commissioner of Human Rights, who said that actually in Europe, although we got throughout the last years a steady accomplishment in the protection of human rights, in Europe there is no ground for complacency. And I would like to mention some of the examples later on. Throughout this year, there's no doubt that the achievement of the convention has been the establishment of a formal system of legal protection available to individuals, covering civil and political rights, which has become European standard for public institutions, constitutional courts, and have embedded the legal system of different members. Landmark cases in bioethics, education, non-discrimination, freedom of expression, and access to the process have defined new paradigms in the European system. Member states reaffirm their commitment to effective international human rights protection while ensuring that their domestic system offers citizens the possibility to redress the human rights breaches at home. In the case Losidou versus Turkey, the European Court described the court as a constitutional instrument of public order, as the President Costa, Jean-Paul Costa, the current President of the European Court on Human Rights, has put it, we have acted as a constitutional court, provided that there is not an European constitution, but we have set up minimum standards for the group of European and Asiatic countries that form part of the Council of Europe. I would like to draw your attention that the Council of Europe is made up by 47 member states, that is compulsory the jurisdiction of the court, and it covers 800 million inhabitants. You would be surprised to know that today till November there's been more than 40,000 applications, and I have here the statistics, allocated to a decision body, 40,000. Per year, there is an average of something less of 2,000 judgments issued by the court, so which means that it's been a success, but in a way the court is being a victim of the own success that I will talk to that later. 54% of the applications coming to Strasbourg come from Russia. More than 25,600 come from Russia, Turkey, Romania, and Ukraine. These four countries made up 24% of the whole applications, the applications filled out by individuals. What we are facing now is a paradigm. We are now enjoying political and civil rights, the one that are contained in the convention, but at the same time, the fall of the former communist regimes has deleted an important tradition in the provision of some fundamental service. I'm mentioning health, education, and pension system. There is an important, in my opinion, threat, especially for Eastern and Central countries when it comes to the access to education and especially quality to education. In just a minute, I wanted to point out some of the weakness, and especially thinking about the economic moment, what are the problem that lies ahead. The first one is threat, I wouldn't say threat, but it will fear to economic conditions, and that means wrong responses to human needs. The cases of immigration, minorities, I come from a country like Spain that used to be a poor country 35 years ago, but now is the recipient of important minorities in Europe. Italy and Spain, especially with the Roma minorities, especially coming from Romania, I'm expecting to see what is the reaction of Italy and France, especially the Europeans, especially as what had to do with xenophobia and what will have to do with how do we integrate these European citizens in our societies. But I would like to conclude with two remarks regarding the Council of Europe is not isolated or is not apart from the international relations arena. In a globalized world, we Europeans, we fail in the new war on terror, but still what is behind the war on terror, it's how we try to protect our institution and our system, how we Europeans responded to this new situation, vis-a-vis or taking into account what has happened in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. Svetlana Todorov, it's a philosopher in France of Bulgarian origin. He posed the question, mighty or right? And probably that is the question. The Hermann Schwarz, in the previous panel, he mentioned that the U.S. has shown a thorough indifference. In the 30s, Alberto Moravia, the Italian writer, wrote a magnificent book called Indifferenti, The Indifferent, said that the reasons that led to the outright of totalitarianism was the lack of involvement of public citizens. Taking the word from Svetlana Todorov, the UN rapporteur of torture, Norman, I forgot the name, Claudia, you can help me. The name of the rapporteur on torture,
Manfred Novak.
He quoted, I'm quoting, ever since the former U.S. Secretary of State, Donald Rumsfeld, authorized the use of the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques in Abu Ghraib, the United States has lost its moral leadership and authority. Novak is an European, he's an Austrian, and he continues, but Europe, we European, have not succeeded in taking the place of the United States as the driving force when it comes to human rights. On the contrary, it's the European perspective, the European image abroad, has been seriously damaged since none of the 47 governments of the Council of Europe were able to publicly complain in an official basis about the situation in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Probably when people have to go on exile, when they seek asylum abroad, when they are refugees, the first thing they try to do is to look for people that speak the same language. I want to believe that in the future years, the language that we speak, the Europeans, mainly is the language of human rights. I'm saying this because the last interim measures adopted by the European Convention, European Court in Strasbourg, are about precisely Afghan refugees seeking for asylum. And the court, applying the principle of non-refoulement, it says that sending back Afghan refugees at the current time would imply a threat to their dignity and a potential torture to these. So the court ordered that British and French authorities to freeze that envoy of Afghan refugees. Thank you.
Thank you, Joaquin. Next is Professor Claudia Martin, who is a professorial lecturer in residence here at WCL. She teaches and specializes in international law and international protection of human rights. A lawyer from Argentina, she is co-director of the Academy on Human Rights and International Humanitarian Law, which sponsors our summer program, the Inter-American Moot Courts Competition, and the annual meeting on human rights, among other things. In addition to the Academy on Human Rights, she and her co-director, Diego Rodriguez Pinzon, are the inter-American reporters on the Oxford University Press project referenced by Professor Shelton earlier this morning. So with that brief introduction, as we're running a bit late, I'd like to invite Claudia Martin to come and share her thoughts on the inter-American system.
Thank you, Hadar and Dean Grossman, for the invitation to be here. When we think about the Universal Declaration and the Inter-American system, we have to look into two instruments, the American Declaration on the Duties and Rights of Man and the American Convention on Human Rights. These are the two basic human rights instruments in the Inter-American system. The American Declaration, which is not very well known, was adopted 6 months before the Universal Declaration, as its universal counterpart, proclaim a list of rights, including civil and political rights and economic and social rights. Similar to the Universal Declaration, the American Declaration had no initial legal force. And it was actually conceived as a statement of goals or as aspirations, as Dean Grossman mentioned. The American Declaration did not envision an enforcement mechanism either. However, in 1859, at a meeting of foreign affairs ministries of the Organization of American States, the ministers decided to create the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. This commission was created to monitor human rights compliance and the human rights situations in the Western Hemisphere. Interestingly enough, the benchmarks according to which the commission would carry out its mission was the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man. So even though initially this declaration had no legal value, by establishing the rights of the declaration as the benchmarks according to which the commission would monitor compliance of human rights in the hemisphere, its legal value was strengthened. Later on, the Inter-American Court on Human Rights decided that, in a very well-known advisory opinion, that the American Declaration spells out the fundamental rights recognized in the Charter of the Organization of American States. The Charter is a legal binding treaty to the state parties to the organization, and therefore, through that interpretation, the declaration has acquired a more convincing legal value. I mention all this because when in 1969 the states of the Americas decided to adopt the American Convention on Human Rights, they decided to incorporate two monitoring bodies, a new commission on human rights and a judicial tribunal, the Inter-American Court on Human Rights. At that time, the states were faced with a very interesting situation. If the new treaty would create a new commission, what would they do with the old commission, the one that they had created in 1959? If they made the commission disappear, a vacuum could happen because, of course, many states would not ratify initially the convention, and therefore no human rights body would supervise compliance of human rights in the Americas. I have to tell you that the convention was adopted in 1969. It came into force in by the end of the 70s, 1978, and if you know a little history, the gross and systematic violations were taking place in this hemisphere, particularly in the country that I come from. 30,000 disappeared people in Argentina and a number of others in Chile, Uruguay, and in Brazil, and Paraguay. I don't want to forget that. Of course, the states of the Americas were aware that these particular countries would not ratify any convention, at least until the disappearances and the gross violations of human rights would stop. Therefore, they decided that the best way to approach the monitoring of human rights in the Inter-American system was to give the commission two different functions. Number one, to continue to monitor compliance under the American Declaration in regard to those states that would not ratify the American Convention, and then to give the power to the commission to monitor compliance with of human rights with those states that will ratify the convention. With this two-track system, the commission, of course, has become a very, I would say, a quite effective mechanism. The relevance of the declaration and the role of the commission continues to be very important, even though a great number of states in the Americas have ratified the convention. Therefore, they have fallen within the monitoring system provided by the treaty. Think about that. There are at least two very important states in this hemisphere that have not ratified the convention, the United States and Canada. In regard to those states, the commission continues to monitor human rights violations under the American Declaration. Though this seems to be irrelevant when you look into the debate of human rights in the U.S., I want to call your attention that the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has been the only forum where individual petitions can be brought or were brought in regard to the Guantanamo detainees. I have here Michael Camilleri, who was representing the victims, and he can give you some information on what has happened with these cases. But again, I want to mention that because in essence it shows the relevance of the commission and the relevance of the declaration to monitor compliance with the states that have not ratified the convention as of today. Of course, since the adoption of the convention, the coming into force of the convention, and the ratification by a number of states, the two monitoring bodies envisioned by this treaty, the commission and the court, have taken center stage. The role of the commission has been very important, continues to be very relevant since the disappearance of the European Commission. A lot of debate has taken place in the system in regard to the role of the Inter-American Commission. But of course, because of this additional role of supervising compliance under the Declaration and the political functions that the Commission has, its role continues to be very important. However, I want to concentrate very briefly on the role of the court because, as Dean Grossman was mentioning, judicial supervision is very important in human rights. If you think about states that have had a very unclear respect for the rule of law, the existence of an international court that would monitor compliance with human rights become very relevant. The role of the Inter-American Court is in monitoring human rights violations in the Inter-American system is undeniable. There are a lot of criticisms to the decisions of the court from many angles, particularly legal academia. But if we look at the impact of the decisions, there is no question that many of these decisions have become landmarks and have become emblematic decisions for the protection of human rights in the Americas. I want to compare three decisions and to make a reference to three different political stages in the hemisphere. We should look at the initial stages of the role of the court when human rights violations, gross human rights violations, plague the hemisphere. The second stage, we could look into the establishments of the new democracies with weak mechanisms to supervise compliance with human rights and the need to deal with the violations of the past. And finally, we could think about a stage that it reflects pretty much the reality now, which is a more established democracies with a number of unfulfilled promises, states that face poverty, social exclusion, and discrimination. How has the court, or what has the court done in regard to these three different stages of the political environment in Latin America? I would say that three emblematic decisions that correspond to the reaction of the court to those political stages are, number one, the Velázquez-Rodríguez case. There is no doubt Dean Grossman mentioned the relevance of the decision. It established that forced disappearances constitute violation of multiple rights, and it also developed the duty of the state to protect, meaning to investigate and sanction the perpetrators of gross violations of human rights. A second decision that relates pretty much to the second political stage is the Barrios Altos decision. This decision declared the incompatibility of amnesty laws with the American Convention. The relevance of this decision refers to the amnesty law adopted in Peru. However, the relevance of the decision has gone beyond the borders of Peru. Actually, Barrios Altos was crucial for the Argentinian Supreme Court to declare the unconstitutionality of the amnesty laws in that country. A third number of decisions that I would like to mention, there is not one in particular, but there are a number of decisions that reflect the role of the court in addressing the human rights of vulnerable groups, are recent decisions on the protection of indigenous communities. I don't have to tell you that indigenous communities are among the more socially excluded individuals in the Americas. The role of the court, therefore, in establishing their right to collective property, interpreting, I would say, stretching the right to individual property protected by the American Convention, again, has been crucial to give a voice and to give rights to these vulnerable groups. Another important development in the case law of the Inter-American Court that has enhance the notion of justice in the Americas is the policy on reparations. Though initially the court was not very willing to award reparations that went beyond compensatory damages, later on the court understood that the notion of reparation for victims of gross violations of human rights in particular has to be more integral. And therefore the court decided to incorporate other measures as part of the reparations in individual cases. I can mention a number of them, but if you look into the cases, you will see that I have very little time to tell you exactly all the new developments in that aspect. But I would like to mention that the court has ordered a number of states to amend their constitutions, to change laws, to create development funds, particularly for the protection of vulnerable groups, and also to continue to investigate and sanction perpetrators of gross violations of human rights. All these developments, again, have greatly contributed to the enhancement of the notion of justice in the Americas. Since I have very little time, I would like to conclude by saying that there are a number of challenges for the system. Resources is usually mentioned, but I'm a firm believer, as Dean Grossman says, that you know, the trick is to see what you can do without money, because if you're going to wait for money to achieve human rights compliance, then I think we will be continue to wait forever. So I guess that resources is a challenge, but we need to see how we can do and protect human rights even with little resources. So I would like to concentrate on three important aspects that I believe are challenges for the Inter-American system. Number one, and that's also something that I agree with Dean Grossman, domestic implementation. The system has been quite effective in terms of convincing a number of domestic courts in following its case law. But that's not necessarily happening in every country. I mentioned that my country has been one of the countries where the case law of the Inter-American Court has been used very productively in declaring the unconstitutionality of the amnesty laws and also in recognizing a number of other important rights that were not necessarily recognized domestically. However, the process has been slow, and there is a lot that needs to be done, particularly because if we don't protect human rights at the domestic level, gaining recognition of them at the international level takes more time and a lot of resources. So again, first important challenge, domestic implementation. Number two is the universal recognition of the system. This has also been a continuous debate in the Inter-American system, and I already mentioned there are two important states that have not ratified the American Convention, the United States and Canada. Ratification by those states would greatly improve the legitimacy of the system and will give a boost to the role of the enforcement mechanisms. And number three, I would like to say that this is a quite difficult challenge, but I think it's a challenge that needs to be addressed anyway, which is looking into socially excluded populations. Dean Grossman mentioned that a number of these individuals are voting. They're not only voting, but they're bringing cases to the Inter-American system. So now both the Commission and the Court are facing the challenge on how to address the needs of these excluded populations. There are a number of cases regarding indigenous populations, AIDS infected populations, access to health, and as you probably know, none of these rights are necessarily recognized in the American Convention. However, again, for the legitimacy and the future of the system, looking into ways to address these needs will become crucial for the success of the system in the future. Thank you very much.
Our final speaker on this panel is Michael Camilleri, who is a staff attorney at the Center for Justice and International Law, CEHIL. He represents victims of human rights violations in litigation before the Inter-American Commission and the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. His perspective as a crucial member of civil society is important to round off this panel and its discussion of international supervision and enforcement. Michael.
Thank you, Hadar, Dean Grossman, for the opportunity to be here and participate in such distinguished company. I want to also begin by just acknowledging and congratulating the organizers of the conference for including a panel on compliance. I think it's really a crucial issue and sometimes overlooked. As I prepared for today, I was thinking back to the first human rights class I ever took as a first-year law student. I remember we were studying the Velazquez-Rodriguez case, and we were studying its importance in the development of international human rights law and the way that, you know, the court shifted the burden of proof and all these sort of legal discussions. And I remember at the end of the class, I rushed up to talk to my human rights professor, who was Henry Steiner, and I said, you know, Professor Steiner, what happened? And he looked at me like I was from another planet. And I sort of felt sheepish and naive and thought, well, I guess you don't ask about compliance in law school. And I spent the next few years feeling sort of embarrassed that I asked him that question, but now that I look back, I think it was exactly the right question. And I think it's appropriate that we take the time in a conference such as this to think about, you know, what the challenges are with respect to compliance. My particular task is to address the NGO perspective on some of these issues. And any of you who've worked with NGOs know that we don't agree on anything. So I'll be offering the experience and the perspective, perhaps, of my NGO, which is Sahil, which is, as many of you know, is an organization that works in the Inter-American system and heavily litigates in that system. And so I'll be addressing compliance fairly narrowly, looking at compliance with case law or judgments in the Inter-American system. I guess I'm going to piggyback a little bit on what Claudia said. I begin by just offering a little sort of a snapshot of what we know about compliance. And I begin by saying that in some ways we don't know that much. That is, the information provided by the Commission and the Court is incomplete on this matter. The Commission does sort of a quantitative, comprehensive analysis in its annual report, but it's a very superficial one that doesn't really allow you to understand, especially in cases where there's partial compliance, to understand exactly what the compliance situation is. And you know, what we do know is that there's full compliance in a very few cases, less than 5%. And the court takes a very different approach. The court issues compliance resolutions in some but not all of its cases, which are qualitative, although not very user-friendly, if you were to try and sort of decipher what the level of compliance is from those resolutions. And again, it's sort of a partial picture that we get from these resolutions, although the court as well has reported full compliance in only about 11 or 12% of its cases. Although we know anecdotally that compliance with court judgments is stronger than with commission judgments. So notwithstanding these sort of information gaps, what do we know? Well, we know that it depends a lot on the measure of reparation. So monetary damages are almost always complied with. Symbolic measures such as public apologies, naming of schools and parks, publication of the court sentence, et cetera, are also usually complied with. And perhaps surprisingly, even orders to reform domestic legislation are often complied with. Then it becomes more difficult. So measures of rehabilitation, such as health benefits, are often not fully complied with, and the same goes for guarantees of non-repetition, such as orders to, for example, to educate or train public officials. And then we get to what is clearly the most difficult challenge in implementing judges, and it has to do with investigating, prosecuting, and punishing those actually responsible for the violations. Here, the level of compliance is fairly low, in some cases total, and this is obviously a major concern, given that it's arguably the most important measure of reparation that the court regularly and the commission include in their judgments. And so this quick mention of the sorts of reparations measures that the commission and the court often order brings me to, I think, an obvious but sometimes overlooked point, which is that in assessing compliance in the American system, especially vis-a-vis other systems such as the European system, we need to keep in mind what is one of the great strengths of the Inter-American system, and Claudia alluded to it, which is that this idea of holistic reparations, or reparación integral, which is, you know, again, one of the great strengths of the system, but makes both compliance and monitoring of judgments much more difficult than it is in some of the other systems. So you can imagine achieving or monitoring compliance with an order to pay damages is much simpler than, for example, creating the conditions so that hundreds of displaced people can return to a community from which they were displaced as a result of an ongoing armed conflict, or an order that a country reform its nationality regime in order to bring it into compliance with international law. And many of you probably know the cases that I'm alluding to. So I think it behooves us to sort of keep in mind that the challenges that are often inherent in complying with an Inter-American case vis-a-vis perhaps judgments from other systems. Now, just to move to conclude with this, to move beyond generalizations about these different types of reparations that are commonly ordered in the Inter-American system, obviously there are differences between states, among states, and also within states over the course of time based on the governments that are in power. I think Peru is a clear example of this. If we look at the Fujimori era, followed by Paniagua and Toledo, and now some backtracking under Adán García. But you know, there are many examples that we could point to. And so the question sort of arises, what can we do to improve compliance, given that there are states that are more inclined to comply than others? And the usual answer, and the sort of obvious one as well, it's a question of political will. And I don't want to underestimate the importance of political will, because obviously it is crucial. But I think it's important that we try to move beyond this and identify other factors that could contribute to improve compliance. And so I'll use the remainder of my time to offer just a few thoughts on that. To begin with, I think the Commission and the Court could play a far more active role in promoting compliance with judgments. And I've mentioned the rather sort of anemic efforts of the Commission and Court to this point to monitor and promote compliance with individual judgments. For a long time, and you know, this may be a resource question, as Claudia mentioned, the Commission and the Court seemed fairly uninterested in doing this in a really robust way. The Court, in fact, under Judge Gonzalo Trinidad's leadership, seemed to be looking for the political organs of the IAS, of the Inter-American system, to play a more active role in monitoring compliance with judgments, and this effort was sort of unsuccessful. And so what we see recently is the Court doing some of the things that Dean Grossman suggested, including having hearings on compliance, holding sessions outside of Costa Rica in order to sort of promote awareness of the Court and try to shame the host government into being in good standing with the Court. And so here I think we may be seeing at least the Court trying to take a more active role in promoting compliance, which I think is probably a good sign, although much more could be done. Second, I think a more modest but similar critique could be made of NGOs. NGOs that represent victims do much of the difficult, tedious work involved in trying to achieve compliance with judgments. But I think it's still the case that as a movement we have tended to dedicate far greater resources to our cases while they're in the litigation stage than while they're in the compliance stage. And given that a case's impact both at the victim level and the more structural level depends largely on whether compliance is achieved, I think NGOs would do well to reassess and recalibrate these priorities. And then there are a series of things that states can do and that we as activists can push states to do that would improve the likelihood that compliance will be achieved. And here I don't have time to get into details, but I'd simply mention the work of Sahil's director, Fabiana Krisisevich, on this issue. Fabiana argues that beyond the more easily identifiable factors that influence compliance, the advocacy capacity of NGOs, the good faith efforts of state officials, the role of the press, the actions of national and political leaders, for example, the institutional and legal structure of a country matters when it comes to achieving compliance. So everything from constitutional provisions that recognize and incorporate international law to ad hoc coordination mechanisms to special prosecutorial units, all things that we've seen in some Latin American countries at least, can make compliance more likely, notwithstanding the obvious importance and the variances in political will. So I'd sort of end on that point with the thought that there's clearly much to be done to improve compliance with judgments in the Inter-American system, but there's also much that can be done. And this, I think, goes beyond simply hoping for a convenient dose of political goodwill when a judgment comes along. Thank you very much.
I want to thank all of our speakers. Unfortunately, we're running somewhat behind, and so I'm going to take the prerogative to defer questions and discussions to a bit later, since Dean Coe's arrived and we have a tight schedule for lunch. Just to sum up, though, the challenges are many, the achievements are great, and the recommendations I think that all of our panelists made are fairly clear and do overlap from their varied perspectives on the universal and the regional and the civil society perspectives. In terms of the need for compelling and thorough follow-up mechanisms, the transparency of the various processes, the political will that's required to ensure supervision and enforcement and compliance, the role of domestic implementation, which keeps
which is a recurrent theme that we've heard starting out early this morning and will continue through the process of our discussions in the afternoon, I'm sure. The need for universal recognition, adoption, and ratification of these norms. The tension between the need for resources and the creative ability to implement and enforce human rights without adequate resources. And finally, the role of NGOs and civil society, and I would say individuals within that, for follow-up and for compliance. In summing that up, there's a lot to think about and certainly a lot to discuss. I hope that we will have the opportunity through the course of the afternoon to do that. Please join me in thanking our speakers for a very robust and interesting discussion. At this